plodding onwards.
Yeah, this is, we're announcing that we're not going away. Last night I was up until like 3 a.m., which is not normal for me. I usually go out of bed about 10 at the latest because I'm old. But I found myself, I was in a group FaceTime call with some friends, and you know, we were having some fun. But I ended up looking back at like Facebook messengers, you know, messages from over the years, and there's like this archive section that I had never explored before, and it was basically every message I've ever sent or received. And I was going down, like, there were messages from like 12 years ago that were there, and that was like me in high school going to college. So that was really kind of like a nostalgia trip. But I also pulled out some interesting things from those, like May 24th, 2011, I wrote to a friend asking for like phone buying advice. they'd asked me, you know, this is just over 10 years ago. My response to like their phone buying advice was, if you want the Nexus S from T-Mobile, you might want to switch somewhere else. Sprint has the same phone, but with 4G, which is faster in bigger cities. 4G isn't supported here, but in big cities like New Orleans, it's wonderful. It will eventually come to here. It's like 10 years ago, talking about 4G as like the cutting edge. And that was probably, I don't know for sure, but I remember Sprint had like their thing, like what was it, like WiMAX or something like that?
WiMAX, yep. Yeah.
Yep, which was not the 4G solution that took off.
Because what Sprint used CDMA back in the day, right?
Yeah.
So WiMAX was like the continuation of CDMA.
Yeah. You don't hear WiMAX anymore. I think they literally shut down the network. But it just gave me some perspective on 5G, because that, like, right now I live in a city here without 5G. But you know, it's 10 years later. And it's like 5G is coming. It'll be faster in bigger cities.
And of course, that message that was still like a year and a half before Apple joined the old 4G game.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. That's right. So that gave me some perspective on, you know, like it spans three generations of network technology, 3G, 4G. And now I'm thinking about it in the context of 5G. I also found an old screenshot in my like nostalgia trip last night, where it was a screenshot of, well, it's December 22nd, probably 2010 or 11 or 2000. Yeah, probably 2011 or 2012. One of those. I'd say 2011, because in the screenshot there's 3G in the corner, which I haven't seen in a long time. But it's specifically a screenshot.
I see 3G still. By the
really?
Way,
just really?
Where I live, yeah, suddenly like very. Not like not every day, but like you know, once a month, I probably see a little 3G logo, just in the wilderness.
And you can use 3G on an iPhone 12. Not that you have one, right? But you just can't force it down to 3G unless that's all you have available. I think,
right? Yeah.
Because I was thinking, like, yeah, but this was a notification from the shortly lived Apple app called Cards. And the alert says the card you mailed to grandma has arrived at the local post office and should be delivered today. What a cool alert. What a cool memory of the Cards app. I loved that app. I think we were talking about it. It came out with the iPhone 4, which is iOS.
iPhone 4S,
which is iOS 5. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it went away like the release day of iOS 7. And it was like the most skeuomorphic app to exist, because it was all about like physical cards, and you would design the card with a photo and with your own custom text inside, and you know, upload a photo from your iPhone, write the text on there. Don't think emojis worked. No, they did. They did work. I tried it before. And then you'd pay, I guess, with your Apple ID, and then a literal physical card on, you know, postcard would get sent through the mail, like letterpress style, to, you know, your contact. And it had, you know, let you pick your contact from your contacts integration. So I love that app. And I hadn't thought about it recently, but that's something I would love to know more about, is like whose idea was the Cards app? Who pushed it through? Who didn't have the influence to keep it going with iOS 7? Was it just like, it wasn't
economical? Skull Forstall, not there.
Yeah. Was it not economical? You know, I don't know. But it was really cool because, like, it would say on the envelope, like, would they post it for the stamp, you know, it would, you'd know this was from an Apple service, you know, not just Apple services online, but like it had some kind of marking on the envelope. And then on the back of it, I think it would have like, you know, made by Apple or something like that. So those were really cool. And I kind of want to like look into it more. Like if anyone has any information on the Cards app from 2011 to 2013, I would love to.
And
hear
it never
stories.
Had an iPad version, right? It was phone only.
Yeah, no, don't recall an iPhone version, but I don't think I was big. I was just getting into the iPad, no iPad yeah. 2.
That's where Instagram anyway. Got the idea.
Right. Yeah,
the Cards app. Doesn't
that's right. That's
like,
right. Just
like
never
Cards
it.
Is. It obviously, you know, if it was super popular, they would have kept it around, right? But it was such a cool little thing, and it's just. You know, and this probably happened like throughout Apple's history, but there's always like those cool little side projects.
iPhoto journals on the web.
Correct. Yeah. All yeah. this stuff. Like, it was just really nice. And, you know, you maybe only did it once a year, but it was fun and it was cool and it was like exclusive. And of course, if you want to make a card, a custom card, you can go on a website and you can
tons
type
of,
it in.
There's tons of apps now, but it's not the same as. You know, the special Apple one.
Yeah, and it was, and they made a big day out of being like perfectly letterpressed, right? And it was just a really nice experience. And it kind of bums me out a little that they've stepped away from all of that, whether it's like the cards or, you know, integrated photo printing and photos and making calendars and books and stuff. Like, they've just shut that all off to third parties. And, you know, like the Photos app on the Mac technically supports like photo extensions, so you can integrate with the third party services that do that. But it's just not the same. Like, if Apple just, you know, took the zero. So if they had a bit more of a tendency to keep zero margin operations going, like yeah, it would just be a nice little thing. Like at Christmas, you just make a calendar, you know. And but no, they have to squash that stuff. Sadly,
yeah, yeah. I was also a customer of the print services and iPhoto, which I think the service called Mimeo is who they sourced that to, but it was never revealed until after they pulled support for physical publishing from Photos and iPhoto. But I bought a number of coffee table books with photos inside and calendars. And that was like a really easy gift for like grandparents and family. It's like, here's, you know, a bunch of pictures that I shot over the last year for your calendar for next year. And, you know, and they'd have cool Apple branding in the way that you don't get from if you use another service. So there's not that makes it any different, but it's something that we appreciate at least, I think. So hopefully I'll learn more about Cards in the next week or so. But it was such a cool thing. And then next I wanted to follow up on the what seems like it's going to be the final Safari design for the iPhone. I think it's the second week of the 10th design so far. And I think I told you last week that I tried the new thing for a little bit where it's like the tab slider on the bottom. And then the toolbar below that. And, you know, I had my critique, of course, was like, you've got Chrome at the top and bottom now, whereas with the old way with the tabs, not as a permanent bar and the address bar on top, you've got, less Chrome showing because the bottom doesn't always show Chrome. So whenever you scroll, it goes away. And in this past week, I've it was during a tattoo session where I had like one hand free and I needed to like, you know, look up something. I did two things. One was, I just kind of realized I've been using the new design since that episode, just to kind of spend more time with it, I suppose. And that's, it made me realize that when I am one-handed, truly one-handed with the Mac size phone, that that's like the one time reachability, you know, where you swipe down with the bar thing. What do you call that?
Home indicator.
Yeah. And that pulls down the UI. Originally it was like double tap the home button to bring it down. It was just easier to do, but
Yeah, the swipe reachability is kind of annoying. I turn it off.
Especially
because I don't have the max phone. I don't have much of a problem.
And they moved it out of like a high level feature to be buried in accessibility. Since a couple years ago.
Yeah,
people have gotten used to bigger phones. But in that moment, I was realizing, oh, I can, you know, there's the address bar and it's reachable and everything. And my instinct, like my muscle memory, was to swipe down on the home indicator and then tap the address bar. And it was just a moment of realization of like, that's the only place I use reachability anymore. And I didn't have to do it then. So it was kind of neat. And of course you can change it easily back and forth from top address bar to bottom address bar, depending on what you need. But the other thing I've used recently, and a friend of mine, I don't think knew about it. And I told him, and it was kind of news to him, but the one-handed keyboard, on the iPhone.
Mm.
So this is a friend of mine who had borrowed my motorcycle and then got hit on the second day. And so he's had a number of surgeries and he's all better now. But like his last surgery, he was like, I really wish I could, use my both hands to type. And I was like, you can make the keyboard smaller and like one sided. And he didn't know about that. Just like, press the emoji key or globe key, whichever it is, long press it. And then you get the option for keyboard settings. And there's right hand and left hand mode where it like gets very narrow, like an iPhone 5S, you know, width kind of, and it's all on whichever side you want to use. And that was useful for him then. And then in this tattoo session, I was like, you know, I wish I could type this message out. and I remembered that and used it, and it was very practical. I think the only thing was the send. I was using my left hand, and so the send button was a large reach over. But it's still a thing that we, prefer larger phones at the cost of the user experience and those kind of, outer reach situations and edge cases. But one-handed mode. And then even on the iPad, like this is something we talked about a few years ago, but on the iPad, the keyboard with the iPad mini today, and I don't know if any others support that anymore, but there's that split keyboard where you type with your thumbs. And then that's mostly, I guess, on the mini, and I don't think it's anywhere else anymore, but on pro iPads, you don't get that option.
Any of the pro iPads that have more keys, they didn't add support for the split version. So I believe the iPad mini and the base 9.7 inch or the 10.5 inch iPad, I believe they still do it, but everything else doesn't. So basically all the pro versions,
yeah,
they're like, nah, we don't need that feature. You don't need that, even though it is so cool, and the animation has always been so cool for that as well, but they just got rid of it completely.
I think it's 7.9, 9.7, and then 10.2 is just the 9.7 scaled up, right? So I think 10.5 didn't get it, which was like a sticky, or maybe it did. It was like the smaller pro gets it in that case, and the larger one doesn't.
The 12.9 definitely didn't, because when I got the iPad not. Pro in 2015, I remember being mad about that. And it's like, oh, I'm sure they'll add it later.
I remember like raising the issue in 2018 or so with a post that was like, you know, here's why this is bad. This is why this is. But there is the solution, I suppose, is that if I'm holding like anything smaller than the 12.9 inch iPad, I can thumb type really well, and so I don't really care about split keyboard as much. And then it's the big iPad that I would like to have split keyboard, because thumb typing becomes like, you know, your thumbs are doing more work to reach across, for me at least, in any iPad, I guess, in landscape orientation. But the solution that they put there is you have an iPhone size keyboard on one of the corners, and then you can type with this one thumb. Or that's the only way that you can swipe type on an iPad keyboard, is when you make the miniature iPhone sized keyboard,
the floaty one.
Yeah, it's like a window. It's like Quick Note on iOS 15 or iPad OS 15.
And just from my perspective on Safari, mm-hmm. I have gravitated towards the bottom, so the new design mode,
mm-hmm.
and the main thing that tilted the balance is the fact that the old one doesn't get any support for the swipe gestures. So if you want to, like, if you've got like three tabs open, you have to be on bottom tab bar mode to like swipe left and right to switch between the tabs without having to go out to the main screen. If you're on the old design mode, there's no gesture. So you like the, and I was getting, you know, muscle memory of the gestures using that quite a lot. And I was on top address bar mode, which I probably prefer just in terms of how it looks and, you know, like organization.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that I couldn't quickly swipe between the tabs was killing me. So I've been moving towards the new design mode as well.
Yeah, I think there's like a swipe up that you do to get to the grid tab view, but that even the animation doesn't look very natural the way they do that. But the way, you know, the original thing I liked about the new Safari design on the iPhone was that it felt like they were taking the gesture user interface from iPhone 10 and applying it to Safari for the first time, just as an app and not the OS. And they've still preserved that with the you know, swipeable tabs, and even the one where you pull in from the right to the left and you make a new tab is still there. So in a whole, I think it's I think people will appreciate it.
Yeah, there'll be a bit of, you know, adjustment period time, but I think the design as it stands today is pretty good. It's not going to be a disaster like Apple Maps or anything, or other times they've changed the design, like the date reel, you know, the date picker reel stuff or the magnifying glass stuff.
So. Yeah, I still think that if the option to keep the, when they have the floating bar address bar, if the option to always have that be there instead of disappearing and resizing everything on the bottom of Safari, I think if that actually worked, people would have liked it more.
Yeah, probably, but it never did.
But it never worked. I was just thinking that today, like one setting not being reliable could have changed everything. So,
Happy Hour this week is sponsored by Basius and the company's new 10,000 milliamp hour portable MagSafe charger and power bank. The power bank is exclusively designed for the iPhone 12 MagSafe charging feature. It's been almost a year since Apple launched MagSafe on the iPhone, and Basius have been relentlessly looking for the best way to integrate it into their power bank. And this is the fruits of their labor. There's 18 built-in magnets to make sure that you can quickly find and attach to the charging sweet spot on the back of the phone. And the 10,000 milliamp hour capacity allows you to fully charge an iPhone 2.4 times. Basius offers more charging capacity than Apple's battery pack at half the price. The Basius is just $49. And of course, it supports more than just MagSafe. So while the wireless charging is only for the iPhone 12 series, you can plug in a cable and use wired charging to power up a Samsung phone, Google Pixel or other Android devices, or, you know, a laptop or an iPad at 20 watt fast charging speeds. The pack snaps on the back of your iPhone when traveling, and it features both a USB-A and a USB-C port to fast charge two devices simultaneously. It's great for business trips, long distance flights, or just going out for a day hike. The design of the Basius power bank is award winning as well. It won the 2021 German Red Dot Design Award for its stunning industrial design, and it even includes an LED display for real time battery percentage. Okay, so if you want one of these, you can get a special deal on the MagSafe charger and power bank. Visit the show notes to find the link. And when you check out, use promo code 9to5MacBase. That's number 9, T-O, number 5, M-A-C-B-A-S-E. Again, check out the link in the show notes for a great deal on the Basius MagSafe charger.
All right. Next up, we are looking at a very popular Apple TV show and its reception so far. So
have you been watching the second season? Are you caught up on Ted Lasso?
I am caught up on Ted Lasso, yeah.
Okay, so there's been a bit of a revolt, I'd say. And like, obviously the first season was like widely beloved and it got really, really popular. And even today it's still like surging in popularity, I think. Like the amount of people coming to the show new every week is still higher and higher. But especially around like the Christmas episode, which was released like a week ago, like not the most recent episode, but the one before that, there was a upsurge, I'd say, of rebellion of people saying the second season sucks, it's boring, not much is happening, there's no conflict. I think part of that's just like people are somewhat just cooling off from the hype train of the first season, right? But I do think it was a little, there were some elements of truth. I still love the second season. I think it's good. And we're only, what, 5-6 episodes in of a 12 episode run, so even if you look back at season one, the kind of like meat and potatoes of the story and the cool, you know, the really cool moments, they came in the back half of the season. And I think what you've seen so far at the beginning of season two is a lot of setup for, you know, stuff to go down. And so there has been like a backlash, and look, people don't like the show, it doesn't matter, you know, it doesn't matter to me, but there was just like a funny, because I just got so used to like looking on Twitter and everyone just like praising this thing. And the last couple of weeks, there's been some, you know, smaller people, bigger people, you know, tech and from the tech side and from like the Hollywood Reporter side, you know, like Variety and stuff, or like the critical side, complaining that the second season just doesn't have the same magical flair. I don't think it's really true. Maybe it's not like at the height of the first season. We'll have to like wait for the whole thing to be out before you can really make a judgment. But I think it's fine. Like, I do think the Christmas episode coming out in August didn't really land for me. Like,
yeah.
It was a good episode, but I think it would have been a lot better if they just saved it for Christmas.
Is it Merry Christmas or Happy Christmas in the UK?
I think it's meant to be Merry Christmas, but everyone says Happy Christmas nowadays.
Which they did not say in the show, which is why it didn't land. Not because it was the middle of summer and it was super hot outside.
I think it was twofold, actually. They did their first, like, win of the season, because, you know, the start of season two, they're just tying, right? They're just having loads of draws. And then the Christmas episode is when they actually start winning. But you don't actually see a win happen on screen. They, like, come into the Christmas episode and they're just talking about, oh, they've had a couple of wins on their back. And it's, so that felt like a bit of a downer, that they'd jump so much of the story where you didn't see, like, a big momentous, like, point of celebration. And then you were in, like, Christmas cheer episode. And the Christmas episode was fun and it was good, but it didn't quite land for me in the middle of August. And then that kind of compounded some restlessness that people had about the first, like, three episodes, where they were kind of like, not much is really happening, it's a bit slow, you know what I mean? And the showrunners actually responded to that on Twitter. They said that they, because when Ted Lasso season one came out last year, Apple released the first three in one go and they did the rest weekly. They expected that same thing to happen this time around again. So they wrote the first three as like a set. So they're expecting the first three to come out in one go rather than it being dropped, you know, episode week, what, single week by week by week. I mean, okay, but firstly, I don't think that shows in general should be writing episodes. Like, if you're gonna have a continuous story, just make one episode out of it, don't make three. Nowadays I feel like so many shows, they just know they're going to be like binge in one go anyway. They kind of pad the first like two or three with like world building setup and they don't give you the continuation. And I think there was a little bit of that in Ted Lasso season two. But even if you're going on the premise of like, oh, let's see what Apple did before, I mean, you can look at the actual patterns that Apple only does the three episode release schedule for season one of shows. Like, when they come back for season two, they only do, you know, one episode or two episodes, maybe at max. Generally, it's only one episode at a time. So I don't really know where the writers got that idea from, that there's going to be three at once. And if you don't want to blame the writers, then I feel like there you should probably blame Apple for lack of communication. Because if I feel like they should at least be talking, you know, their biggest show on the platform should maybe get a little heads up about how it's going to be distributed, so they don't make wrong assumptions about what's going on. You know what I mean?
And wasn't season two made and done before the hype was so obvious about Ted Lasso?
It was mostly written, yeah.
It
was like they started the writing room for season two like in like September of last year, and they finished it around Christmas. So, and I don't think Ted Lasso really like exploded loads until, you know, it wasn't like post Emmy season or anything, you know, like it was because they started filming it in January or February. So yeah, it was definitely planned out like way back when, and then it was mostly written between that time.
Yeah. I've seen the entire season of Ted Lasso season two. And
have you?
I can guarantee everyone it picks up. Ted Lasso and the team go to the moon. And there's a big space battle with the Russians. And it's gonna
I think you're getting your screens mixed up.
It's going to pick up in the last three episodes, trust me. Now, speaking of Emmys, the Calls and For All Mankind are Emmy nominated, right? Or did they win something? I don't know.
They won because basically the big Emmy show is coming up in September. Okay. And For All Mankind isn't nominated for the main Emmys, unfortunately. They didn't get a look in. What was announced this week was it's like the awards that don't really matter, but Apple won them anyway, so they're cool. It was like, yeah, short film original idea or whatever, and that's what Calls won. Okay. And then the thing For All Mankind won for was not the show, it was for the AR app they released.
Okay.
So the Time Capsule app got like, I mean, award, it won for like most innovative media experience or something,
yeah,
of that.
I told you when we first got that Time Capsule app, I said, this is going to win an Emmy. That's what I said.
Time Capsule app is cool. Like, but it's not quite to the heights of, you know, like the proper primetime Emmys.
Yeah. Have you seen Calls yet?
No, I haven't. I keep meaning to.
Doesn't take very long.
I know. I'll do it.
Yeah, it's good.
So Ted Lasso season two, have you been liking it or not?
Yeah, I have. Like, I've got a friend of mine named Daryl, who every week on Friday, on Thursday, he's hyped about Ted Lasso coming out the next day. And then on Friday, he says Ted Lasso in our group chat as soon as he's seen it. And then once I say Ted Lasso as well, then we can discuss it. But yeah,
the only thing I think I really don't like about the whole season so far was just like the opening gambit of the dog situation.
Yeah.
I feel like that like the impact on, you know, the Danny Reyes character could have been done in a much better way. And it felt A, really improbable, and B, just kind of like depressing. And C, it was just kind of like I wasn't sure whether I was meant to be like laughing or but they took it like super seriously. Like, I don't know. It didn't really land. And for that to be like the first 5 minutes of the episode for the entire of the new season, it was a bit of it didn't quite hit the mark. But that was probably been like my standalone complaint, really. Everything else has been, you know, fine.
I think I haven't counted swear words, but I think the F-bomb is increasing.
Yeah.
And the edginess is like, the innuendo there is there's a lot of trickery, and like, you think this is going to be, you know, like, are they really about to do this? And then they don't, but they get close. So it's, I've been plenty entertained. The Christmas episode was just so far off from anything in the rest of the show so far that it was just, well, at least it's only one episode. I enjoyed it, you know, it just didn't fit with the rest of the show so far.
Yeah. And critically overall, like the season two is still rated like, you know, 100% on Rotten Tomatoes and stuff. So, and the critics on season two saw the first 8 episodes, I believe. So, if you trust them, it's obviously still going to keep the quality of the first one.
They haven't seen the moon battle yet.
No, they haven't. No,
they haven't. Maybe no one will. I don't know. They might have changed their mind.
All right, let's take a break and then we can get away from some Apple TV Plus stuff and we'll get into some cool anniversaries and Apple news. So, Happy Hour This Week is also brought to you by BetterHelp. It's a stressful time. Life is hard normally, but the pandemic didn't help matters, you know, and we're now in through like half of 2021 and it's still around us. So if you feel strained or just not as happy as you do normally, you might just want someone to talk to who's trained about mental health and lifestyle. And BetterHelp is quite literally here to help. It lets you do just that from the comfort of your own home. BetterHelp assesses your needs to match you with a licensed professional therapist tailored to helping your personal well-being. You can connect in a safe and crucially private online environment. And after signing up, you can start communicating to a therapist in under 24 hours. This is not run-of-the-mill self-help. This is a professional counseling service done securely online. You can access counselors specialized in all sorts of areas like stress, anger, relationships, depression, sleep, and much more. You can start a conversation with a therapist at your convenience. You can just send them a message at any time. The therapist will respond on a timely basis, and you can also schedule more personal sessions like weekly video chats or phone calls if you want to as well. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid options are available. And of course, everything that you talk about is 100% private and confidential. So start living a happier life today. As a listener to this show, you can get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/machappyhour. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, BetterHelp.com/machappyhour. Happy Hour This Week is also brought to you by ExpressVPN. Do you ever read that fine print that appears when you start browsing in incognito mode in Chrome or private browsing mode in Safari? It says your activity might still actually be visible to your employer, your school, or your internet service provider. And you might wonder why they bother even calling it incognito mode at all. To really stop people from seeing all the sites that you visit, you need to use ExpressVPN. So think about all the times that you use Wi-Fi at a coffee shop or a hotel or even at a friend's house. Without ExpressVPN, every site that you visit could be logged by the admin of that network, whether you're in incognito mode or not. What a VPN does is it encrypts your data and it hides your IP address from everyone in the chain, including your actual home internet service provider, you know, Comcast, AT&T and such. And in fact, in the US, those ISPs are actually legally allowed to sell your browsing data to advertisers. ExpressVPN stops all that. It encrypts all of your network traffic and it reroutes it through a network of secure servers so that your private online activity stays private. I've used ExpressVPN and it really is great. It's super fast and it's so simple to use. You can stream HD video with no buffering. And that's something that isn't generally the case with a lot of the cheaper VPNs that are out there. The ExpressVPN app literally has one button to press. You tap it to connect and boom, your browsing is secured and hidden from prying eyes. So stop letting strangers invade your online privacy. Protect yourself at expressvpn.com/happyhour. And you can use our link at expressvpn.com/happyhour to get 3 months extra for free. That's expressvpn.com/happyhour to learn more and sign up. Thanks to ExpressVPN for sponsoring the show.
Yeah, ExpressVPN, they still can't protect you from someone being behind you. That's what those windows in Chrome say. Is but everything else that you'd expect is there. All right. We are, I mean, we talked about this before. 2021 is a big year for 10-year anniversaries of the very eventful year in Apple's history of 2011. And one of those anniversaries, 10-year anniversaries, happened this past week, which is not the death of Steve Jobs, but the retirement from CEO. I think he changed his position on the board to just be chairman and not head of the board, I believe. And
no, he was CEO and then he became chairman of the board.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is basically like resigning from the top job.
Yeah. And you know, in comes Tim Cook, as was his plan, you know, Steve Jobs' plan. So that's a big one. I mean, you know, 10 years. Wow.
It's kind of crazy how fast time goes, you know, like, for a while, it was all about, could Apple survive under Steve? And then that slowly, like, faded away as everyone realized that, you know, Apple's going to be perfectly fine. And now you're in the era of, like, what is Tim Cook's legacy going to be? Because, you know, only a couple of months ago, we had that interview where Tim Cook basically intimated that he wasn't going to be at Apple for the next 10 years, right? Like, so the clock's ticking. At some point, Cook's going to move on. But if you actually look, Steve Jobs has been at Apple for about 14 years when he was, you know, when he on his run. And Cook is currently at about
his return 11 to Apple.
Yeah. Obviously, like, you've got to ignore the 80s run, but like continuously, he was running for like about 14 years in a row, right? And Cook is at 10, 11. And although he's not going to be there for like 20 years, as he said, he's not going to be there for the next 10, you know, 5 years, another 5 years on the plate. He could easily like eclipse the duration of the job, you know, the modern Jobs era time period. It's kind of crazy to think about, but
yeah, you know, Steve Jobs did not resign because it was part of a plan, though. It was his health, if you recall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So,
like,
so for Tim Cook to surpass that as
yeah, if Jobs hadn't had his, you know, health situation, he would still be the CEO today, right? Like, that was just who he was. He built the company with his bare hands.
Yeah, and man, the iOS 5 keynote where iCloud was announced, iTunes Match at the time. That was like, I don't think any of us thought he would be there in person, or definitely not presenting. And I think at the beginning it was like, yeah, I couldn't miss this one, you know. And even though you could tell he wasn't, you know, at his full health anymore.
Yeah, no one expected it to also be his last one, right? But that's unfortunately how it turned out. Like, because obviously when he, you know, he had that big leave in 2009 where Phil Schiller took over with the keynotes and stuff, and Cook was interim CEO then, right? And then Jobs came back and he did the iPad, and he was kind of pretty present through like 2010 for the iPad. And then he started to, you know, he did the iPad 2 keynote as well. But then there was never like a concrete event that caused a massive down spiral, but you could just kind of tell that it wasn't going too great. But then he was there for WWC, so it's like, oh, maybe he's going to carry on again for another while. Like, you can never predict someone's like decline, but like, even at the WWC 11 keynote, I don't think anyone really expected him to retire from his role, from his post, like 2 months later, because that's what happened in August, right?
Yeah. And I was, you know, we were talking about this, I'm 30 now, and so I was 20 then, and I vividly remember the moment that I found out. I was working at the Apple store in Boca Raton, Florida, and I wasn't there at that time on that moment, but I was at home, literally in the process of like taking a couch down from the second floor and bringing up a new couch, and CBS was on, the channel CBS was on the TV, and there was a breaking news alert that Steve Jobs had died. So not 10 years ago when he died, but you know, that was in October, a couple of months from now, 10 years, you know, from that. And it's one of those things, like, you know, there aren't 100 moments or more that you remember where you were exactly at that time, but that's one that stands out to me, is like, stop what we're doing and, you know, go look at the TV. And then it's like, you know, it weighs on you. So like you said, even though we all knew his health wasn't great from cancer, that it was still a surprise when it happened. Even though he'd stepped down from the role of CEO and was just chairman by then.
Yeah, I mean, even Tim Cook said in interviews that he expected, like, he would just, Jobs would have just carried on being chairman for, you know, many years to come. And unfortunately, it was a, you know, obviously a big steep downward spiral between August and October.
Yeah, yeah. And like I mentioned, I was working at the Apple store at the time. And so by the, when there, you know, come October, you know, when he passed away, there was sort of a memorial service at Apple's headquarters at One Infinite Loop in Cupertino, and before Apple Park was a thing. And speaking of last products, Apple Park, you know, there's things like his last public appearance was in you know, a Cupertino town hall session describing Apple Park, you know. And but on the retail side, as just an employee, then we closed the store in the middle of the day to all be present to watch the stream of the memorial service where, you know, Tim Cook spoke, Johnny Ive spoke, I want to say Coldplay played maybe.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was like on a big screen in the Apple store with all the lights turned off and like the front windows blacked out, you know, as if it was like what, you know, a retail reset when you put out new products, you know, and that's the kind of thing that, you know, you know, you're sentimental or you appreciate moments in Apple's history to be able to view that live at the time was in that setting was special. Yeah.
Yeah. And I can't remember what I was doing when he died, but I do remember where I was when he resigned as CEO. Like I was pretty young as well at that time, obviously. And I was on holiday with my family in Turkey, and it was just like a, you know, just a random day in August or whatever, and we were just in the hotel, and all this, we had the TV on, and of course it's in like a foreign language, it's in Turkish or whatever, like no one could really understand what's going on, we were just like biding time before dinner or something, and on the screen, like this picture of Jobs holding up an iPad just appears, and then it took like another like 2 minutes for me to work out what the story actually was. It's like, oh, he's resigned and stepped down, oh dear, like, and it's such the most like inconsequential thing in the world, but I just remember that summary. Like, I probably can't remember anything else from that holiday. I just remember seeing the picture of Jobs fly by on the TV screen. And I was like, wow, he's resigned. Crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a weird, thing that, you know, your brain remembers.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I suppose we'll have, more on the anniversary of his death and more of those moments in October. Remember like the big thing then too, at the time was like, the iPhone 4 was amazing. There's these iPhone 5 rumors of a teardrop shaped phone that's like an iPod Touch in size. And everyone's like, where's the iPhone? Like, you know, waiting for the iPhone 5. iPhone 5 hype was huge. And there was no new iPhone in that September. I think by then we were on the schedule of it was the summertime, right? When new phones were.
Yeah, because the 4S was the first one to be in October.
Yeah.
In the fall. Yeah.
Well, it was it part of WWDC
before
that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Before the iPhone, up to the iPhone 4, it was just WWDC. Like,
yeah.
That was most of the WWDC keynote. It was just Jobs and just announcing the new iPhone.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, his last iPhone presentation was the iPhone 4. And it was like, stop me if you've seen this before, because it was the big Gizmodo leak. And then describing like what the antenna lines actually were and how it was so different from the phone before it. But yeah.
All right. One more Steve Jobs story while we're here.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have been lucky enough to have replies from Apple executives over the years on various emails that I sent. Not so much as recently, but I had a good string of it, especially when I was a bit younger. And I've got replies from like Phil Schiller and Eddie Q. But the most prized one was when I got a reply from Steve Jobs. So I just emailed sjobs@apple.com like everybody else used to do back in the day. Not expecting anything. I'd probably done it like 5 or 6 times total. Can't really remember what the other subjects were, but this one's immortalized on 9to5 Max and what those on Mac stories, because Jobs actually replied to me. So this is really cringy reading this back, but I'll go for it. So
go for it, basically.
To give a bit of context, at that time, March 2010, I didn't have an iMac. I didn't have any Macs at all. We would sync up like the family iPhone to a Windows computer. And one of the cool new features that Jobs had literally demoed for the iPad that year, which obviously was announced in January and March was around the time when it was coming out, was the fact that the photos would be sorted into those stacks of like faces and events. And it wasn't like the modern day thing where the processing would happen on the device, or it was just basically syncing your library from your iPhoto library on your Mac. So all of the organization and stuff would happen on iPhoto on the Mac, and it would just copy across those settings to the iPad. But there was no support for that on Windows. All you could do on Windows was sync photos, but you wouldn't get the tabs for events, faces, or places, which is really cool. So I was, you know, in my incredible innocence at like 11 or whatever, or however I was back then, 13, maybe, I don't know. I was like, oh, I'll just email Steve Jobs. I'm sure he'll get it. He'll get it sorted out. So what I wrote was, the iPad photo app looks incredible. Are there any plans to support Picasso's faces and albums in iTunes so I can take full advantage of the Photos application since Photoshop album is long discontinued? If not, please can you look in supporting the Picasa library format? And if people don't remember, Picasa was Google's original Photos application. So before they had like Google Photos and stuff, they had like a direct, you know, Windows clone of iPhoto, and they called it Google Picasa. I sent that on the 20th of March at 2:30, and Jobs replied at 4:00. Steve said, no, but iPhoto on the Mac has much better faces and places features, full stop, sent from my iPhone. Like, what a great reply. Like, I obviously, you know, with my, you know, much more mature self now, obviously Apple had no interest in supporting Picasa or Photoshop album. What was actually Jobs also going to be like, yeah, we're going to support Google software really well. But it's just like, I memorialize that because it's such a good answer. It's just like, no. But iPhoto on the Mac has much better faces and places features. Like, it's such a perfect, like, Jobs reply that, you know, the kind of nature, the same kind of nature that you get when you watch, like, the D conference and stuff. And
yeah,
I just got that in an email one day, which is cool.
Yeah, that is cool. Yeah. It made me think of, I've discussed some Schiller emails before that I've received in my old NFI Mac, but one was, remember when the HomePod came out, but it wasn't out yet, and there was, like, a review of it on Reddit that was talking about, I don't know, what it was like to experience the HomePod. It was one of the early review units that wasn't press. I don't think. And I think something had happened where it was, the comments had called out some error, and eventually the whole review was like removed. And Schiller had linked the Reddit review on Twitter. And when it was kind of, you know, taken back from whatever the perspective, error was, I emailed Schiller to say, like, you know, hey, did you see this? Do you think your tweet should stay up? And he replied back with, should I delete it? What do you think? That's kind of, I mean, it's kind of good to take back that feedback, you know, but, I never had a Steve Jobs email, but,
did you send him ones?
No, I didn't. I wasn't as on the radio. I mean, I had an iPod Nano, and I knew that about Apple, but it was not close enough to it at the time. Like, it just felt, you know, like something for adults, and it was
yeah. Because I probably only sent Jobs like 4 or 5 emails, and it's basically all in like 2010, and he replied to one of them. But, I mean, yeah. I'll take one. Like, a lot. It's a lot better than a lot of people get.
Yeah, but check our show notes. We'll have our colleague. Parker Ortolani has done a really good Remembering Steve 10 Years Ago Today story this week on August 24th. And it's got, you know, all the links into the coverage. I think, 9to5 Mac 10 years ago, where our publisher, Seth Weintraub, wrote the news as it was happening, and the letter from Steve Jobs, you know, saying he's stepping down, and, you know, press releases, and even the sort of like the coverage around the world and from other press outlets. So I think that's a really cool way to look back at it and see. And he also has a really good look at sort of how Steve Jobs became CEO of Apple, the company he founded after being pushed out for so many years. And it's a really cool piece, and it even includes, as we'll probably talk about more in October, or talk about again in October, the iPhone 4S keynote, where there was a chair marked reserved, and, you know, it was symbolic for Steve Jobs, who was, I think it was October 4th, that iPhone 4S event. And that was, you know, a sign of, you know, the reserve for Steve Jobs. He was still alive, but it was the very next day when he actually passed away. So But check out that piece. It's if you've, you know, don't recall much from this, or you want to kind of re-experience, you know, the memory, then it's a really good piece that Parker did.
Yep, agreed.
Yep.
Happy Hour this week is also brought to you by She's Birdie. Whether you're walking around your own neighborhood, going for a walk in the woods, running errands, or whatever else, you always want to feel safe. And with the Birdie, you can keep doing what you love to do with just that added peace of mind. Birdie is a simple and sleek personal safety alarm. It's designed to be easy to carry and simple to use. You can carry it in your pocket, or maybe put it in a bag, or attach it to a keychain. And if you do get into a situation where you are worried or you feel like you're in danger, it just takes one quick pull to activate the Birdie. It will activate a loud alarm, it emits a 130 decibel siren, and it also turns on a flashing strobe light to help deter any attack. And unlike something like portable pepper spray, the Birdie poses no danger to you, which means you can feel confident to activate it without worry. Now, Zach, I know you got sent one of these, right? So I'm hoping you haven't been in a dangerous situation recently, but what do you think of the Birdie?
Yeah, no, I haven't been in a dangerous situation, but I did share them with family, and it's because they're so compact and they're so, you know, you don't look at it and think this is a protection device. You look at it and think, you know, it's just a cool little accessory, and the colors are all nice, kind of in the iPod nano chromatic fashion. And, you know, I think that that's important to making it something you actually have with you. So it's a great little product.
Birdie goes wherever you do. The compact alarm comes in multiple colors and a brass keychain, so it can be easily attached with your keys or attached to a bag. And there's been hundreds of thousands of Birdie alarms already sold to date, with thousands of five-star reviews. Join the flock today for a safer tomorrow. And right now, She's Birdie is offering Happy Hour listeners 15% off your first purchase when you go to shesbirdie.com/happyhour. So go to She's Birdie, that's spelled shesbirdie.com/happyhour for 15% off your first purchase. Once again, that's shesbirdie.com/happyhour.
All right. I wrote a thing on a whim this week that I didn't really know where I was going with it until I started writing it, but it was basically what it ended up as was an 8 months on review of AirPods Max, the over-ear headphones that Apple calls AirPods, and, you know, that aren't like the traditional AirPods. And kind of the gist of it is, like, you know, in the last couple of months, I realized that I have not missed one day of using AirPods Max for at least an hour as, like, my headphones for whatever I'm doing at that time. And it's largely about music. I mentioned on the show that I've used AirPods Max for watching Apple TV, and it's like if I'm just watching TV alone, because I'm in an apartment right now, I can do, you know, surround sound, and it's all nice. And if I've got company over, I'll do that. But when it's just me, like, I can watch anything on the Apple TV and put on my AirPods Max and, like, walk around the house, do dishes, and if I don't have to, like, look at the screen, you know, it's I don't lose the audio in a different room. And if I am watching, like, a movie or something, it's really great because turn off all the lights, you know, big screen TV, and it's really immersive, and it doesn't feel like you're listening with a pair of earbuds or something, you know. And but for the music part, I think that these have become, like, my, if there's music I want to listen to, this is the set of headphones that I use to have, like, the full experience of listening to this music. I would say before it would be my car stereo. I go for a drive and, like, play something at a high volume and, you know, kind of get an experience that way. But these AirPods Max have placed even that, because and listening with AirPods Max, you know, I'm not, you know, audiophile, and I don't have a huge interest in trying a bunch of different headphones. And, you know, obviously with nature of what we do is the appeal of trying, you know, and evaluating what Apple has done with higher end headphones. And I've really been impressed. And also looking back, like the early, like the first impression, I think I was kind of down on them. I didn't really love the way they looked. And of course, they're, you know, Lightning port, not USB-C, and no wireless charging at all, which is kind of, you know, a given on AirPods Pro and almost a given on AirPods regular. And so that was the, you know, and that was kind of the weird thing was these are great, but they're not all of that we kind of expected or wanted them to be. But and there were also issues with battery life and the case accessory that came with it. They call it a smart case. And then there was
they call it a smart case, but it doesn't do anything apart from just put your headphones into the idle state quicker.
And at first it took like many days to even have that effect, and then they changed the way it worked to be much sooner. But looking back 8 months, of use now, that case lives. It used to live in my backpack, and when I would take my headphones in my backpack, I would put it in the case that was just in the bottom of my backpack. They just now the case thing lives up in my closet in my bedroom. it's not even in my backpack anymore, and I haven't had the issues with scratching the headphones or anything like that. So the only issue, if you could call it one, that I've had is that I really actually do like to work out with them when I'm in the gym, in the same way that you see people with like Beat Studio in, mm-hmm. in the gym. And the ear cups, it's so good that they are so easy to take off, magnetically you detach them and put them back on. But I've certainly had the need to wash them and then like have them sit out in the sun to dry because I could buy replacement ear cups for like, I guess that specific purpose, but even so they certainly hold the aroma of a post-workout. in writing the piece, I also talked about something that I don't really think we mentioned on the show, but I think they came out in December and I didn't pre-order them because I wasn't so sure, but a week later when they were actually in stores, I was able to get a pair delivered from an Apple store in the early morning. And it was really neat. The experience with spatial audio was very cool, and like watching something on the iPad and having it be really immersive. I was watching the screener of For All Mankind season 2 at the time, and that was really impressive. And I would demo the post credit scene from the first season, and it was just really a very good demo, and people would be impressed with them when I showed them. The price is still high. When I try to talk to people like you and my brother-in-law, he's into audio equipment. I'm like, you can get them for $450. They're on sale sometimes, and it's like that's still a lot of money. when I moved from Orlando and back to Mississippi in March, I was still on the fence about these things, and they were about just the cost alone, and how much value I was getting out of them. And I ended up selling the first pair that I bought, I don't think I made a profit, but like at cost, because they were still hard to get in stores and online at the time. Like I think deliveries were 3 or 4 weeks out still. And so I did go like a few weeks without AirPods Max, and I went from being on the fence to really missing them and kind of missing the experience of just how much better they sound than AirPods Pro, which sound way better to me than AirPods normal. There was a pair in stock and in town, even though I think deliveries were still kind of a bit out by then too. But I got the pair in stock, and that's whenever I went from being on the fence and kind of shy about the price, and is this really worth the commitment, could do other things with that money, to looking at it like it's a one-time purchase. And as long as I'm actually using them because I like them and not because they're relatively expensive, then I'm satisfied. And so now I don't think about the price anymore, because that was many months ago. And presumably they'll, I'll use them for years to come. But I think in kind of summary, when I was finishing this story, I realized that I listen to music every day, and music is very important to me. Songwriting and lyrics, and also just music aspect of it. And I create music, and music's always been very important to me. And I've realized that of course you can say this to any other headphone that's premium, but that the convenience of AirPods Max and the feature set with spatial audio for video, I don't really care about it for music as much. And then the difference in audio quality, even loudness, that you hear in music is makes them, to me, I think about them as like my music accessory, in the way that I used to think about the iPod as, you know, this is where my music lives. Now it's the AirPods Max. And, I think even more than like a set of HomePods around, because these can go with me to the coffee shop or, you know, throw them in my bag and use them all about, even though they cost more than, you know, a pair of HomePod minis or even one.
You can buy like a HomePod mini for every room in your house.
Yeah. Again, the cost I cannot get behind, but, you know, but that was kind of the realization at the end of it, was because I didn't really know what angle I was taking. I was just thinking, I sure am fond of these headphones in the last couple of months. I want to write something about that, and ended up being kind of that long-term perspective on using them and how much I've enjoyed them. So, and then I think one key point I had to include was the noise cancellation, even compared to AirPods Pro, which is very impressive. I mean, you've got an earbud in your ear, so there's some natural noise cancellation plus the sound isolation it does, and the ability to switch to transparency where you hear what's around you better. That's all very good with the AirPods Pro, but it's just way better on AirPods Max naturally, because big cans versus earbuds in your ears. I realized like one behavior that I have is as a single dad, you know, I take care of my two kids every day, and, you know, we get all the essential things done and everything, but like there is a lot of comfort in like having my headphones on, listening to music, you know, at the end of the day or in the evening, and listening to a podcast even, and being able to switch easily between transparency where I have a conversation with them, to noise cancellation where they can fight with each other and I don't have to feel the stress of that, you know. So that they come in handy that way too. And I'm really happy about them. The only thing I said that in the piece that I was a bit miffed about was the whole thing where, you know, Apple comes out with higher quality music and AirPods Max just have no real support for that at all. You know, you definitely can't use the higher the highest quality stuff,
the lossless stuff. Yeah.
But,
I mean, that's so, just going to be like, as long as they're Bluetooth headphones, that's always going to be a limit. Like, ideally, they could add like a wire, like over the wire, that you can maybe get a higher bitrate output. Maybe.
Yeah, that's where I feel a bit miffed, is that, you know, I even have the wire that you can buy with it, and, you know, this is what we discussed at the time, was it was really confusing then, but now it's really clear that even with the wire, you can't yet do anything. I think there's some hope that maybe there'll be some update in the future that makes the wire work, but I'm not holding my breath.
They certainly haven't shown any enthusiasm to do that. Yeah,
plenty happy with what they do.
I'll tell you what, Zach, I'm still tempted, you know? I am still tempted.
This week we were talking about show stuff. It was before I wrote the article or around the same time. And I asked if we could include a session in the show where I convinced you to buy AirPods Max. You're like, no way. And then this is how it went.
So. You snuck it in here, yeah. I haven't discounted them. We said this on previous shows as well, but they're cool. And I kind of want them, but I've just got other more important priorities at the moment.
When they first came out, I told you not to buy them because we talked about your use case, your needs. Yep. It's like, you know, you don't need them. And
all that stuff remains true. That's part of the reason I don't own them.
Yeah.
But I'm sure I would like them if I got them.
I don't need them either, but I'm quite fond of them. And
Indeed.
Yeah. My ending advice in the piece was, you know, if you are interested at all in the appeal, then close your eyes and click the buy button and don't think about it ever again. So, and then I wanted to give a few updates on AirTags. It's really short.
Have you lost something?
I have misplaced a number. Well, I've misplaced my keys a number of times. I have a small apartment right now, and I'm moving to a larger house in September. But even in a small apartment, I'm able to misplace my keys in times that are not opportune. And so I have actually like pulled out the Find My app, made the keys ding, still not super sure where they are, and then used the precise locator to get in the ballpark of where they are. And I'm sure without AirTags, I would have found them because they were somewhere that I would have searched for. But it's really neat to be able to skip the whole search process and just find them. And then I had an AirTag in my motorcycle, but it has its own location feature that I finally got activated. And so my daughter was interested, and she's like looking at the AirTag, what is this? I told her what it is. And she's like, can I put it in my backpack? I'm like, yeah, sure. So, so now she has that, and she turns her phone off at school. So I can't use, Find My from her phone then, but the AirTag totally works. I see she's at school on the bus, you know, making it home. So, and that was at her request. So it's kind of cool. And then iMac story here. Something I've been enjoying on my iMac for the last few weeks is the photo booth app, which
wow, how you talk about going back 10 years.
yeah, the photo booth app. And what I have a whole process now where I've got my desk set up, and my keyboard piano is right over here next to it, like a second desk over there, and then my guitar, a couple of guitars and an amp are right over here. And so through part of the day, every day while I'm working, I'll pick up the guitar and just kind of play around. And what I've been doing is recording these in Photo Booth as videos, and then I'll go back and look at them. And usually what I do when I'm playing guitar is I play until I'm kind of worn out, and then I have lost the esteem of, like, you know, it feels I really want to put it down, now I'm tired. And I'll walk away with and kind of a negative feeling about having played guitar for, you know, just for fun. And with recording it in Photo Booth, that's like opening the camera on an iPhone or iPad, but it's the big screen on the Mac, and that's where, you know, that's where you do that, unless you do QuickTime or something. But it's very natural with Photo Booth. And I've realized, like, going back, you know, a day later or later in the day to like rewatch something I was doing is a really good way of just doing a quick kind of putting down an idea. And so I've now have a process with Photo Booth on the iMac where I record a bunch of videos in Photo Booth, but those don't sync with iCloud, and they don't sync to iCloud Drive even, because they go in the photos folder. You could switch that up, but by default they don't sync or back up offline. And so, or back up, you know, to a cloud service. So, my process is, when I've got about 10 or 20, I go in Finder and I show all contents of the Photo Booth library and the photos album, and it shows you the actual files, and I just drag them into the photos app and they get synced up. So, it's Photo Booth.
Using Photo Booth to record music with a guitar while wearing AirPods Max. You know, you're already becoming a Mac commercial, you know, the what do they call it? Behind the Mac. Just put a nice little, put you in black and white. You could be in the next ad.
Yeah, it's cool. Like, I scoot my chair way back so I can see the guitar on the screen and I can look at, like, what I actually did, and I just have to, like, try to figure it out again. And I have Photo Booth on my dock. It's that important to me. So, and remember I told you when we were talking about, like, the decade of selfies and the origin of the word selfie and everything, I told you
before
the iPhone, my selfies all came from Photo Booth on my MacBook Pro. It's like, it's still important to me. It's on my dock. Yeah.
Finally this week, Happy Hour is brought to you by ZocDoc. Did you skip your doctor's appointment during the pandemic? I know I did. You missed the eye doctor, the dentist, and maybe your physical checkup too, but now that everything's opening up again, it's about time for us all to catch up on our regular healthcare needs. And if you need to find a great doctor in your area, download the free ZocDoc app and instantly book an appointment. Go to ZocDoc.com/happyhour to get the app and sign up for free. With ZocDoc, you can search for local doctors who take your insurance, read verified patient reviews, and book an appointment either in person or via video chat. It's really that simple. You don't need to wait on hold with a receptionist ever again. You can easily compare doctors by their ratings and read reviews written by real patients. ZocDoc spans the gamut of doctor services, with thousands of providers listed in one application. Whether you need primary care physician, a dentist, dermatologist, psychiatrist, eye doctor, or other specialist, ZocDoc has got you covered. Every month, millions of people are using ZocDoc. The ZocDoc app has a super clean and simple design, so booking in for an appointment is just as easy as adding an event to your calendar. And so now is the time to prioritize your health. Go to ZocDoc.com/happyhour and download the ZocDoc app to sign up for free and book a top-rated doctor. And many are available as soon as today. Once again, that's ZocDoc.com/happyhour, spelt ZocDoc.com/happyhour. Thanks to ZocDoc for sponsoring the show.
Yeah, not ZocDoc. I'm not a doctor, but
ZocDoc. A proper doc.
So TestFlight is it's on the Mac now this year, and I think now it's actually, like, functioning. Is that right?
Yep. Yeah. So they announced it at WWDC. It showed up earlier this week, kind of out of the blue, but it wasn't functional, and now it's all working. So developers can submit Mac betas for the first, they can submit Mac betas to test like for the first time ever, which is just insane seeing as it came to iOS in like iOS 8 timeframe, right?
And it was a service on iOS before that.
Yeah, because it was a stand, it was like a separate company and then Apple acquired it and it's just taken like 8 years to make its way to the desktop.
The Mac is still required, like before test flight comes to the Mac, it's required, you know, some kind of ID code from your Mac that you got to go to like system profiles to find and then send to the person that's distributing you the app. So it's not easy. This makes it easy for them. And does it have to be App Store apps? I think it doesn't, right?
Well, for iOS, it definitely has to. I'm pretty sure it probably has to be App Store apps.
Really? Okay.
I mean, you could just make a beta and never release it to the store.
Yeah.
Which is kind of cheating, but yeah, I think it's App Store apps only. Mm-hmm. And it's also, I believe it requires the macOS 12 SDK to actually work. So if you have like an app that's being built with older SDK versions, you still can't use it. So there's going to be an on-ramping process and some developers are annoyed that they're not going to be able to adopt it immediately, but at least it's there in some form for people to use.
In a few years, because it'll be just a built-in stable of the Mac and everyone can use it.
Yeah, because if you think about like me, you know, when I do like daily dictionary releases, I make test flight builds of them because it's so easy, right? You just upload to the App Store and you make a test flight build out of it. And then I did those Mac utilities like Tabstar Links or a Jetbar, right? I never bothered to make betas for those because they're small, you know, they're small kind of like hobby projects anyway. And secondly, it was so hard to actually do it. Like, I don't want to be there managing people's like device IDs and stuff. If there was a test flight solution, I would have just uploaded a test flight, made a link and tweeted it out and people could have tried it, you know, while it was in beta. But when I made those apps, that wasn't available. So it was just a dumb limitation of the overall like ecosystem. And I feel like we've seen that a lot this year where macOS Monterey is basically defined by parity with iOS, right? And yes, it would be great if Mac was also getting loads of crazy new features, but it's also good that they're just keeping them lockstep. Because I think the worst outcome is when like the Mac has some features and then the iPhone and iPad have like a completely different set of features and they don't, you know, it wasn't that many years ago where they would be like on completely separate trains doing completely different things and the unity and the parity wouldn't be there. Be like, why is this not over here? I don't know. They just didn't do it, right? It's nonsensical.
I quite like having my focus status appear on my menu bar when I set it, but also activated on the iPhone and the Apple Watch and the iPad or any other way around. I'm satisfied with it. Remember when Test Flight was like previous to being bought by Apple, Test Flight was one option. Hockey app was another option.
Yep.
And, you know, betas would be in both apps depending on who their preference from the developer. And then Microsoft bought Hockey after Apple bought Test Flight. That was a wild time. And I was on to the Test Flight story the morning that it was like the day it was announced early in that morning, but I couldn't nail it down. But I had like someone tipping me, like showing me the breadcrumbs to find the story. And I didn't write it, didn't get enough for it. but yeah, it was a long time ago, probably like 2013, 2014. Don't know.
It's really been a look back episode, this episode.
I was thinking about that after seeing our notes and I'm thinking like, is this part of aging? Like, I'm not going to start talking about the
good old days,
the good old days, the way that you always hear like John Gruber talk about the PDA Newton. Can no one relate anymore? I don't know. Let's talk about now about all the major changes in iOS 15 beta 7.
Huge release. Huge release of beta 7.
Can't believe we saved it for last because this is like the next hour of conversation.
Yeah, there's so many changes. No, there's pretty much nothing at all. In fact, the only thing that really was notable was Apple has officially made iCloud private relay. It's going to be in the shipping version, but it's going to be off by default and it's going to be labeled as a beta because they haven't rinked out all the kinks in it.
They want to expand compatibility with more websites was one of the reasonings, and that's what we saw on like day one was, oh, you can't load cnbc.com with this turned on. That's interesting.
Or it thinks you're in like a random country even though you've got the maintain general location thing switched on. And it completely, I actually had that the same day beta 7 came out. I logged in on Amazon and it did the thing where it sends you a text message to alert you that you've logged in, and it was like, I literally logged in on my phone and it sent me a text message. And it was like, new login from like VA Massachusetts or something crazy. I was like, am I getting scammed here? What is going on? And then I realized, oh, it's because I got iCloud private relay on my phone. It doesn't know my location. Yeah. But then when I went in settings, I have the maintain general location thing switched on, so it should approximate the UK, you'd think, not some American state, but that happened.
Yeah. Apple Watch news. I'm so excited for the Apple Watch because it seems like these renders that we're seeing from John Prosser and others, that it's this flat design, sort of like the not iOS 7 style, but sort of like the iPad Pro and the iPhone now and the iMac for that matter, that it's applied to the Apple Watch, which is very exciting. This week we have a report that the new screen sizes, it seems like, will be 41 millimeter and 45 millimeter for the Series 7. 45 being a slight increase, 41 being the same level of increase. if you recall, like, we started out with 38 and 42, and then we went to 40 and 44. Now we're going to 41, 45. And the idea is that you aren't actually increasing the size of the casing very much, if any at all. You're making the display fill more of the casing, you know, by making the bezels slimmer. And
yeah, and remember, because Apple follows like the horology or whatever, these are unlike an iPhone screen, which is measured diagonally, they measure the Apple screen vertically. So
vertically.
It's 45 millimeters in height.
Yeah.
That's the size. But yeah, it's obviously not going to be as dramatic as the 38 to, you know, the Series 4 screen size transition, because it's only a millimeter increase. But you can't imagine they're going to make the bezels bigger. So you're getting slightly bigger screens on these new models.
Yeah, I've had a bug in watchOS 8. When you're customizing your watch face, first of all, they got a new flow for that in watchOS 8, which I think is very good because it pushes you through each step. It's different from the launch interface where you swipe through all the faces or all the different modes, but I think it's more natural and more discoverable that you can customize a face in a certain way. But there's a bug in watchOS 8 beta for at least on the Series 6 where you'll like save a setting on a configuration of a watch face when you're doing it from the watch, and then this, what's like the preview is bigger than the display, you know, it's oversized for your watch face, for your watch display. And just, we knew that like a screen size change was on the table for this year, but it just made me think, is this what's happening? You know? So I'm excited for the Apple Watch in a big way this year.
And we believe that it's probably going to get announced alongside the iPhone, sometime in September.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think the current rumors going around are September 17th iPhone release day. Yeah, so like event on like the 7th or the 4th, and then event on the Tuesday the 14th, and then pre-orders on the Friday the 17th September.
And then ship the week after that Friday, right?
And then ship the week after, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, can't wait. It's going to be exciting.
It would be cool.
And then finally there's this Apple News Partner Program that was announced today, which is what? Because I haven't read this yet.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, right? So Apple, obviously, headline, right, 30% commission, right? That's what everyone thinks of, 30% on internet purchases. But that's not really true anymore, right? Because there's so many exceptions and exclusions and weird, like, get-arounds. So if you make under $1 million a year, it's 15% for the small business program. If it's a subscription and you're on the second year of the subscription, it's 15%, so it's only charged at 30% on the first year, right? If you are a video app participating in the video partner program like Amazon Prime Video, HBO and HBO Max, etc., then you can also only get charged at 15% commission, and you're allowed to use alternate payment methods if the user already has alternate payment methods on file. So you can't like get them to add a credit card through the app, but if they've got one through their like Amazon account on the website, they're allowed to pay with that through the application, which should normally be disallowed, right? That's an exception for the video partner program. And to be in the video partner program, you basically have to integrate with the TV app, and Netflix famously doesn't. Well, today Apple announced the Apple News Partner Program, which is kind of the equivalent, but for Apple News. So if you're in the Apple News Partner Program, a publisher will agree to have a significant presence inside the Apple News app, which includes adoption of the Apple proprietary format, Apple News format for generating the articles. So if you add an article to Apple News, your options are either for it to basically give you like the preview from the RSS feed, or you have to generate this like alternate format version. So it can't just be HTML. It's like this transform version in Apple's like Apple News format, which allows for like some animations and transitions and stuff. But basically, if you are a publisher who agrees to do that, then you will only ever be charged for 15% commission inside your native application. So in exchange for giving Apple News some content to show, And it, on the Apple News content, you can have your own adverts, and Apple doesn't take a cut of the advertising revenue. So you can keep 100% of the advert revenue inside of Apple News. In exchange for that, your first year of subscription in that purchases will only be charged at 15%, not 30%. So you're getting, I guess you're getting a bit of a discount, but it does feel, it doesn't feel as good a deal as like the video program, because with the video program, you're giving these streaming services the opportunity to sell directly with the payment methods on file, giving Apple no commission at all, right? What all the Apple News Partner Program does is it gets you 85% commission in the first year, sorry, 85% of the revenue in the first year rather than 70% of the commission, the revenue, because Apple's always going to take 15% for subscriptions that last longer than a year anyway. It's only that first year time frame. And again, all, you know, all these publications that make over $1 million, it's most of them, right? So they get in charge 30% in the first year and then 15% every year after that. But if they join the Apple News Partner Program, they'll only be charged 15% flat. But the trade-off for getting that extra 15% revenue in that first year period is that you have to basically commit to putting a decent amount of content onto the Apple News app available for free without a subscription, just supported by advertising. So it feels like quite a big concession to make just to get an extra 15% in the first year.
It's a clever bribe, but it's not a very good bribe, it sounds like. Like, I was wondering, but when you were introducing this, is this what it will take to get the New York Times and the Washington Post in the Apple News app, where you can, you know, you pay for News Plus, for example, then you can see everything or most everything like you do with Wall Street Journal? It doesn't sound like it, though.
No, like if it had the same rule about alternate payment methods, I feel like it'd be a much more compelling opportunity for them, because then maybe the New York Times would do it, and they would just allow for the fact that they already have a load of, you know, tens of millions of people subscribed direct to them, so they'd just be able to do that as well through the iOS app in exchange for maybe putting, you know, like 10% of their articles in through Apple News with supported by ads.
But even if New York Times does just a basic, you know, maybe they already do this. I think they already do this, but you know, not News Plus, where it's a subscription included with the service or with Apple One. But it's, you just have something, you have content in just the Apple News for free section. By doing that, then every time that New York Times gets a new subscriber on their iOS app standalone, then even though it's just for the first year, that they'll always have new subscribers in their first year. And so it's not just 1 year of benefit for the New York Times. It's, as long as they have new subscribers, there's always a benefit there. So it's not as bad as it could be, I guess, but it does.
Yeah, because right now the New York Times is not in Apple News Plus, nor are they in the free bit of Apple News either.
Yeah, they left, didn't they?
They left. Yeah, they were originally in it and they departed. But it doesn't seem like to me the extra 15% money for 1 year per user is going to be the split in the difference to actually get them back in. Maybe it is, and like, it feels like Apple and IDQ and what wouldn't have announced this program if they didn't have like key partners that are actually going to want to do it. You know, like kind of like with the video partner program, they basically like negotiated it with Amazon, right, in advance, and that came out in those emails, and then they released it as a program that pretty much anyone can apply for. So maybe the same's happened here, but we haven't yet seen like who's quote now on board.
Okay.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like a great proposition. Personally, like, I feel like the video partner program has much bigger upside for what you have to do.
Yeah,
but I guess they're trying.
It's something. I wanted to say this week too. Seriously, thanks to everyone who listens to the podcast all these years and who interacts with us and keeps making this program possible. I think in the early days of this podcast, back to reminiscing and looking back there. It was like an additional task on top of all of the other responsibility of our jobs. And just at some point over time, it became not just an additional task, but like one of the, for me, like three important tasks, you know, especially like revenue streams. I think it's about a third of my monthly revenue. And so that's pretty cool. You know, thanks to our listeners just tuning in, then we're able to attract new advertisers. And then that gives, I've recently associated a lot of positive feelings about doing the podcast, not just because of the interaction with our listeners and 9to5Mac readers, but because I think about it as like, and do this once a week, and that's a pretty good gig too, all on its own. So
yeah, and that's, you know, that counts for people that are subscribing directly, but also the, you know, thousands of you that just listen to the ads and listen to the show every week. Like, it's all fantastic, and
that's right,
and yeah, we appreciate it all.
Actually, I have no view inside of subscribers who subscribe to the Apple Podcast for $4.99 per month or $49.99 per year to have no ads in the episodes, and maybe a higher quality if you can hear it. But I do appreciate those two, because I will have insight in the future as to how that turns out. And I know you have insight now, and that's really much appreciated. But yeah, I mean, I'm talking about like in bulk of everybody who listens, because it effectuates change in my daily life. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. And we loved it in the show as well. So it's just plodding onwards.
Yeah. We're announcing that we're not going away.
We'll be here. And which is going to get great in the next few weeks as, you know, product season really begins.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be real good. Every week you tell me that we had a good show after we're finished recording.
I mean, that's because we do.
Well, and I agree with you variably depending on how well I did, I think. But you're the constant here where you, every week there's no variable with you.
It's not true.
Yep. Well, all right. That is the Happy Hour Podcast for this week. If you enjoy the show and you're a new listener, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Google Play, anywhere you get podcasts. If you want to hear the ad-free, Spotify. If you want to hear the ad-free version in Apple Podcasts, it's $4.99 per month. Is there a free trial to that?
I can't remember.
You know, I don't pay to listen to it ad free because I can't, because I listen to you do the ads and they wouldn't go away even if I paid. So it's a tough proposition for me.
I don't think there's a trial. I think you just have to do it.
Okay. Well, if someone asks me for a sample episode, I can probably bootleg it. But I appreciate all the subscribers there. And if you have any feedback for the show, you can email Benjamin and I together at happyhour@9to5mic.com. You can follow and contact me on Instagram and Twitter at Apollo Zach. That's APOLLOZAC. And Benjamin, you're on Twitter at
BZA Mayo.
See everyone next week. Bye.
Bye-bye.